And now,
the definition. Definition.
As you've seen throughout the month, it has been the unplanned and the unannounced which has been the fulcrum of every milestone in the Occupy movement. Saturday night, as a piece of tape we played earlier showed, when police clashed with protesters in Times Square, an American veteran of the war in Iraq stood up for the people behind the barricades.
Why are y'all walking like there's a war going on? Nobody has guns!
I'm in New York City. I am from New York City, and these cops are hurting people that I fought to protect. There's no reason for this. There's no honor in hurting unarmed civilians, and I won't let it happen.
Sergeant Shamar Thomas is a Marine veteran, served two tours in Iraq, took part in Fallujah in the second battle. Comes from a military family. Both his parents are veterans. His father served in Afghanistan, his mother in Iraq. It's an honor to have you here, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Why'd you go to Times Square Saturday night, particularly wearing your medals and your uniform?
I initially went to the protest on October 5th, and I saw the police brutality, and it made me want to get involved even more to, you know, the understanding that, you know, we have young men and women out here who are trying to inspire, you know, change. And so why wouldn't I want to be a part of that? So that's, you know, my goal in life is to inspire a generation, you know?
Well, obviously, because as I suggested, this was it was not Sergeant Thomas night on the schedule, and yet it sort of became that. What you were shouting in a way that you could see in the policeman's eyes, they were listening and didn't know what to do, and there were people, passersby didn't know what to do, and protesters didn't know what to do, because obviously you were hitting a chord with these people. What were you trying to say? And obviously we have the quotes, we have the tape, we played it, but what was in your mind as you were, you know, expressing yourself in that vocal manner?
Well, I've been to Iraq twice. I've been in, I was in a riot in Rupa, Iraq in 2004, where we had rocks thrown at us, and after the rocks were thrown, we didn't go beating up people and arresting people, you know what I mean? We kind of treated it with a level of humility, you know what right. I mean? And to have the cops beating, I saw, you know, a cop punching a woman in the face, you know, to see that in my own country, that, you know, my family fought for this country for people to have a right, and these people are peaceful. I haven't seen a video yet where I've seen right. them try to hurt the cops. So why are they using batons and sticks? Why are they in riot gear when nobody's trying to riot, you know?
Did you have a sense at the time that they were listening to you?
Oh, I know for sure they were listening yeah. to me. I have no doubt in my mind that they were listening to me. I had the fire in my gut, you know, yep. so to speak. Like, they knew what I meant. You know, I've been to, you know, on over 50 combat missions, so the intensity is there. They know that I'm telling the truth. You know, they know in their hearts what, you know, what I'm saying is right.
With good reason, in the last 10 years, particularly the New York Police Department has gotten a little militaristic in their point of view
yes.
because they now are trained that everything could be fatal. And that's probably a good attitude to have given what happened in 2001. There's an understanding of that, at least where it comes from. However, not every situation is fatal.
Exactly.
And it seemed like you were a cold bucket of water against their sort of fevered what's going to happen now
exactly.
thing, because you've actually been in the real thing where it was life and death, and this
exactly.
was not it, and that was what you're trying to get to them.
It's a time and place for things, you know. It wasn't when the situation arises where the you know, the crowd starts getting frantic, that's mm-hmm. when it's time to say, you know what, the crowd is getting frantic. When people are just shouting, you know, we are the 99%, come
right.
join us
right.
these are not, you know, a chance that incite violence, you know what I mean? So why, you know, the riot police were in, you know, in form, just walking, marching up and down the street like, you know, like it was a battle going on. And I've been in battle.
Right.
It was no battle going on.
Right.
You know?
The other side not only didn't have weapons of any kind, they didn't have the rocks yet. They're not
no
even,
rocks.
There's no stage at that point. Give me your assessment of the messages that are coming from Occupy Wall Street, and are you in favor of them, opposing the corporate greed and holding the banks accountable and supporting the middle class, principally those three?
I support everybody's view. I tell people all the time that I'm not a part of any political mm-hmm. party. I'm not a part of any group or anything like that. I'm an American citizen.
Okay, so then what does this mean to you?
What this means to me is that this is our time and our generation to change the greed that is in America. Like, both of my parents did 20 plus years in the military, and they have to find jobs now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I recruited for the Marines for 4 months, and it's like I taught kids to come join the Marines. So it's like, come join the Marines, and then what are you going to do after you get out of the Marines? You know what I mean? So it's like, we don't, there's no you know, there's no place for us to go now. You know what I'm saying? So,
is there a place you think in Occupy, in the entire movement, in the protest movement that's beginning in this country, for veterans' rights, and particularly recent veterans' rights, to be addressed? Should there be some more attention paid to this fact?
Well, that's the whole thing with the uniform.
Sure.
That's what I tell people. Like, you know, I want to inspire the veterans to come out, because a lot of veterans have this thing where they don't want to speak against the government. They're so, you know, trained, like, oh, no, if I speak, you know, speaking against the government is wrong, you know what I mean, because we have a chain of command, you know. But yeah. I don't think it's about a chain of command. It's about a way of life, you know. You understand what I'm saying? So
chain of command goes both ways. Sergeant Shamar Thomas, U.S. Marine Corps, whose mother, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather also served this country through Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam and World War II.
Yes.
Great thanks to you for your service, to them for their service, and spectacular work on Saturday night.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in here this evening.
Thank you.
As you travel the country, you also take credit for tightening regulations on Wall Street mm-hmm. through the Dodd-Frank law, and about your efforts to combat income inequality. There's this movement, Occupy Wall Street,
right.
which has spread from Wall Street to other cities. They clearly don't think that you or Republicans have done enough, that you're in fact part of the problem. Are you following this movement, and what would you say to its people that are attracted to it?
Obviously, I've heard of it. I've seen it on television. I think it expresses the frustrations that the American people feel. That we had the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, huge collateral damage all throughout the country, all across Main Street. And yet you're still seeing some of the same folks who acted irresponsibly trying to fight efforts to crack down on abusive practices that got us into this problem in the first place. So, yes, I think people are frustrated, and you know, the protesters are giving voice to a more broad-based frustration about how our financial system works. Now keep in mind, I have said before, and I will continue to repeat, we have to have a strong, effective financial sector in order for us to grow. And I used up a lot of political capital, and I've got the dings and bruises to prove it, in order to make sure that we prevented a financial meltdown and that banks stayed afloat. And that was the right thing to do, because had we seen a financial collapse, then the damage to the American economy would have been even worse. But what I've also said is that for us to have a healthy financial system, that requires that banks and other financial institutions compete on the basis of the best service and the best products and the best price, and it can't be competing on the basis of hidden fees, deceptive practices, or you know, derivative cocktails that nobody understands and that expose the entire economy to enormous risks. And that's what Dodd-Frank was designed to do. It was designed to make sure that you know, we didn't have the necessity of taxpayer bailouts, that we said, you know what, we're going to be able to control these situations so that if these guys get into trouble, we can isolate them, quarantine them, and let them fail. It says that we're going to have a consumer watchdog on the job all the time who's going to make sure that they are dealing with customers in a fair way, and we're eliminating hidden fees on credit cards. And mortgage brokers are going to have to be straight with people about what they're purchasing. And what we've seen over the last year is not only did the financial sector, with the Republican Party in Congress, fight us every inch of the way, but now you've got these same folks suggesting that we should roll back all those reforms and go back to the way it was before the crisis. Today, my understanding is we're going to have a hearing on Richard Cordray, who is my nominee to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He would be America's chief consumer watchdog when it comes to financial products. Now, this is a guy who is well regarded in his home state of Ohio, has been the treasurer of Ohio, the attorney general of Ohio. Republicans and Democrats in Ohio all say that he is a serious person who looks out for consumers. He has a good reputation. And Republicans have threatened not to confirm him, not because of anything he's done, but because they want to roll back the whole notion of having a consumer watchdog. You've got Republican presidential candidates whose main economic policy proposals is we'll get rid of the financial reforms that are designed to prevent the abuses that got us into this mess in the first place. That does not make sense to the American people. They are frustrated by it. And they will continue to be frustrated by it until they get a sense that everybody's playing by the same set of rules and that you're rewarded for responsibility and doing the right thing as opposed to gaming the system. So I'm going to be fighting every inch of the way here in Washington to make sure that we have a consumer watchdog that is preventing abusive practices by the financial sector. I will be hugely supportive of banks and financial institutions that are doing the right thing by their customers. We need them to be lending. We need them to be lending more to small businesses. We need them to help do what traditionally banks and financial services are supposed to be doing, which is providing businesses and families resources to make productive investments that will actually build the economy. But until the American people see that happening, yes, they're going to continue to express frustrations about what they see as two sets of rules.
I want to bring in Senator Bernie Sanders now, an independent from Vermont, who joins us live from Burlington. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
You have a new op-ed in The Guardian Online, and you write, "The truth is that millions of Americans lost their jobs, their homes, and their life savings because of the greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior of Wall Street." Yet while millions of Americans, as you say, have lost their jobs and their homes, these self-same banks were bailed out by the taxpayers, and they're about to start paying themselves massive year-end bonuses. How have they got away with it?
Okay.
Well, that is the $64 question, and I think that is what these demonstrations around the country are about, and that is what the anger of the American people is about. Bail these guys out, they caused the recessions, millions of people lose their jobs, and now these guys are doing better than they ever did before. And the answer to your question is, the simple reality is, Wall Street is the most powerful economic and political entity in the country. They have unlimited resources, they buy and sell politicians. And they have been able to protect their own interests and their own well-being.
And you know that every single time there's a Republican presidential debate, it is almost like a harmonious chorus from every single individual candidate saying what we need are fewer taxes and fewer regulations. Cut back on the regulations. That's what they keep telling us. And yet I thought one of the reasons why we had the catastrophic circumstances of 2008 was principally because there were no regulations. Nobody was regulating the derivatives market.
Well, Martin, you're absolutely right. Wall Street spent, if you can believe this, $5 billion over a 10-year period through lobbying and campaign contributions in order to get to the deregulation so that they could end up doing whatever they wanted to do. They did whatever they wanted to do. They put worthless products out onto the marketplace. They created a Ponzi scheme. The bubble burst, and we are in the terrible recession. The idea that any serious candidate for president could say, well, what we need is more deregulation because we really trust Wall Street is beyond comprehension.
Can you characterize that form of thinking? I mean, is it lunacy? Is it idiotic?
No, it is not lunacy and it is not idiotic. What it is people who are working, candidates who are working on behalf of Wall Street and the wealthiest people in this country. They do not see their job as rep. Look, these are the same people who want to end Social Security and Medicare, make massive cuts in Medicaid and education, while they give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. Their job, frankly, is to represent the wealthiest people in this country, which certainly includes Wall Street, and they could care less about the well-being of average Americans.
I guess,
but
I guess
the idea is,
I guess you're actually referring to Eric Cantor, because he's been dismissing these protesters, as you know. How much longer do you think he can carry on defending the wealthiest people in this society, knowing full well that there are 14 million people out of work, poverty is at record levels, there's a Jobs Act available for passage through Congress, and yet Mr. Cantor has absolutely zero interest in it?
Well, you're exactly right, and that's what the struggle is about. Look, these guys have tremendous amounts of money. They pour huge amounts of money into candidates' campaigns. They lobby very effectively. And what our job is right now is to educate, organize the American people so that everybody understands that these Republicans are in the pocket of big money. They could care less about ordinary people. We've got to throw them out of office. We've got to deal with the Democratic Party, which in my view is much too conservative. We need a progressive agenda which says the government is going to work for all of the people in this country and not just the wealthy and the powerful special interests.
I was shocked, Mr. Sanders, by another line in your piece where you talk about $5 billion being spent by financial institutions to achieve their goal of repealing financial regulations. $5 billion. Can you just reassure me that you're not exaggerating?
No, we are not exaggerating. Over a 10-year period in their fight to get deregulation, that is how much they spent. And let me give you another fact which may shock the American people today. Despite the fact that we bailed out Wall Street, Martin, because you remember they were too big to fail, three out of the four largest financial institutions are bigger today than they were before we bailed them out. And altogether, the six largest financial institutions have assets that are the equivalent of 60% of the GDP of the United States of America. So you have a handful of entities with enormous economic power, with incredible wealth that gives them tremendous political power. And the struggle now is to take them on. In my view, you got to break them up. You certainly have to bring back significant regulation so that they do not engage in the Ponzi schemes that have led to this recession.
Mr. Sanders, how is it possible that people like Eric Cantor appear to encourage capitalism for everyone until a bank fails and then socialism is acceptable because we have to bail out the banks, we have to support them? But all of us, individual citizens in this society, well, if capitalism swipes us aside, we have to accept that.
That's right. I mean, and as it happens, it's interesting that you mentioned Mr. Cantor, because he is one of the leaders. He was one of the leaders of the bailout of Wall Street. So when the financial institutions, because of their recklessness, illegal behavior, are about to collapse, Eric Cantor is there to provide all the help they need. But when the middle class is collapsing, when small businesses are hurting, in that case, the government should not play any role. In fact, we should move the other way and cut programs that working families and low-income Americans need. Martin, what this is called is socialism for the rich, free, rugged capitalism, and free enterprise for working families.
Just a final question, Mr. Sanders. The president has spent the last few weeks taking this jobs bill to the people, pleading with them to call their congressional members, to make phone calls, send emails, demand that Congress answers why they won't support this bill. But are you going to have any effect here? Because you and I know that with the election coming, many of these Republicans have been absolutely transparent about what their agenda is about. And it's got nothing to do with the unemployed. It's got something to do with one man who is employed, he's in the White House, and they want him out.
Now, I think your characterization of where the Republicans are coming from is exactly right. And what our job is to make sure that everybody in America understands that we right now, and I would go a lot further than Obama does, I must tell you, but we have the capability by rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system, creating millions of decent paying jobs, which we desperately need when unemployment is as high as it is right now. And the Republicans have zero, nothing to say except the old trickle-down economic mantra, give more tax breaks to billionaires More deregulation, I guess, of Wall Street, more unfettered free trade, which has already cost us large numbers of jobs. So what we have got to do is make it clear to the American people that this Republican control over the House has been a disaster for our economy and for working families.
Senator Bernie Sanders, as ever, thank you so much for joining us there in your constituency.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Hedges. I'm a writer. I write books. I spent 20 years overseas as a war correspondent. Came back and realized that corporations had carried out a coup d'etat in my country. And I've been fighting back, although not as effectively as you guys. Well, I've covered movements. I covered all of the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. I've covered both of the Palestinian intifadas. And once movements like this start and articulate a fundamental truth about the society that they live in and expose the repression, the mendacity, the corruption, and the decay of the structures of power, then they have a kind of centrifugal force. You never know where they're going. I was with the leaders of the movement, the opposition movement in East Germany in Leipzig on the afternoon of November 9th, 1989, and they said that perhaps within a year there would be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. In a few hours, the Berlin Wall didn't exist. What happens is, in all of these movements, this was true in Prague as well, is that the foot soldiers of the elite, the blue uniform police, the mechanisms of control, finally don't want to impede the movement. And at that point, the power elite is left defenseless. So where is it going? No one knows, even the people most intimately involved in the organization don't know. All of these movements take on a kind of life and color that is in some ways finally mysterious. The only thing I can say, having been in the middle of similar movements, is that this one is real, and this one could take them all down. Well, let me first say I learn a lot more from the people who are occupying than, my critique of the corporate state, I think, coalesces with the critique that many people in Occupy Wall Street have, but I never wrote in any of my books about how to bring them down. This whole non-hierarchical structure is really brilliant, and I didn't have a clue. Because they can't destroy the movement like that. The fact that you rotate people through positions of leadership, and the fact that you're completely transparent, the fact that you realize that you've clearly been provoked. I mean, Anthony Bologna was trying to provoke people in that crowd because they want windows smashed. They know how to handle that. They don't know how to handle this. This is driving them insane. And the fact is that I can guarantee you that huge segments of those blue uniform police sympathize with everything that you're doing. And that is the way you can shatter the manacles of control that have been placed on the country by the corporate state. And that's what scares them. I mean, the most aggressive figures in the crowds are these white-shirted assholes. Always remember that you only have to deal with them, once in a while. These poor uniformed cops got to deal with them every day. I think the movement's really, 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 really smart, really astute, and I don't really think I have much to teach it at all. I don't think there's any danger of this movement being seduced or co-opted by MoveOn.org, which is a reprehensible organization, or the Democratic Party or anyone else, or the Teamsters. The fact is, what you've done, what they have not done, which is fight back. And because you've fought back, they've been exposed for who they are, i.e. the leaders of this group. That's why they're running to you and attempting to restore what little shredded credibility they have left. You know, I'm a visitor. I come and go. But I don't sense that there's any danger. I think the sort of political consciousness of this group is so high that they see through all of these figures who show up the park. I mean, I was there when Patterson showed up, Charlie Rangel showed up. I mean, it's sort of almost sad in a way, because the fact is they have offered nothing, done nothing, except, of course, Mao, this empty rhetoric, this kind of feel-your-pain language while betraying the very people they purportedly represent. So I don't think there's any danger of this movement being co-opted at all. I think that you know, even with the Teamsters, the union bosses, and these union bosses are pulling down five times what the rank and file is pulling down, they've done nothing for unions except basically barter away their benefits and rights. And in fact, you know, the union bosses have to get down here because otherwise they're going to lose their rank and file. That's why you're seeing groups like Move On or Teamsters coming down here, because you do what their leadership has not done, which is stand up. And let me just say something. I wasn't here Friday morning. For me, I got kids. And it's not about me anymore. It's about the next generation. It's about my children's generation. And I think my passion for what you're doing, and I would even use the word love, comes from the fact that I look at you as fighting on behalf of, like, my little three-year-old. And when I, on Friday morning, of course I was up to find out what happened, and I did what I do now, which is start crying. God bless you all.
It's the story that's ignited fierce passions across the nation as allegations of racism and miscarriage of justice tear apart a small Florida town. 3 weeks ago, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black teenager, was shot down by a white neighborhood watchman who claimed self-defense and has not at this point been arrested. And it's caused a public outcry that spread like wildfire. ABC's Matt Gutman brings us the latest now from Sanford, Florida.
This is the face of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, whose death has provoked weeks of demonstrations and massive internet petitions, and tonight, a rally in New York City.
Justice!
Now!
Justice!
Now!
And in the small city of Sanford, Florida, a vote of no confidence for its embattled police chief.
Don't shoot me! Don't hurt me!
These are just the latest twists in the case
in solidarity
that is galvanizing the country following the shooting death of Martin. On February 26, he left his father's fiancée's house to buy Skittles and iced tea during the NBA All-Star game, making his way along this path. And Crime Watch volunteer George Zimmerman spotted him, began to follow him.
These assholes, they always get away.
Are you following them?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
But Zimmerman does anyway. He begins chasing him.
This guy looks like he's up to no good or he's on drugs or something.
As we learn from his girlfriend, Martin at this point is terrified.
He said his men were watching him, so he put his hoodie on.
ABC News was there exclusively as she told her story to the Martin family attorney.
I said, what you following me for? And the man said, what you doing around here? Somebody push Trayvon because the head stayed this down.
A torrent of 911 calls.
A guy is raising his hands up. He's saying he shot a person.
They're wrestling right in the back of my porch.
I'm pretty sure this guy's dead out here. Holy shit.
The residents reporting these chilling howls. And then that single gunshot.
There's gunshots.
Zimmerman immediately claimed self-defense, which investigators on the scene accepted. But investigators also ignored key witnesses, ABC News has learned, and failed to contact others like Martin's girlfriend.
The police department definitely needs to go back, re-interview everyone and anyone that has any information, as well as the FBI. I guarantee you that's what they're going to do. That's going to be their first stop.
And all the while, Sanford police claiming they are handcuffed by the law. The law is called Stand Your Ground, Passed in 2005, it allows someone to use deadly force when they feel threatened. Since the law, justified homicides in Florida have jumped threefold. 20 states have similar laws, but Florida's is seen as the most extreme.
Mr. Julie, what do you want to say about what happened?
In fact, another man on trial for manslaughter in Florida right now is invoking the law to try to get the case dismissed. And back in 2007, Norman Borden fired 14 bullets into a pair of men he thought were gang members. Under the law, he walked free. Zimmerman hasn't been charged with a crime, but even friends say he might have gone too far.
So this is the route that George Zimmerman used to take in his nightly patrols.
Yes.
Frank Taffy was a former block captain of the local crime watch and worked with Zimmerman.
Pulling out his weapon and shooting seems extreme. It doesn't really sound like self-defense to most people who hear about it.
I agree with you. But then again, something ramped this altercation to the point where use of the deadly force happened. And, you know, we have a young boy who was killed, and we just can't bring that boy back. Sad. My heart goes out to the family.
Martin died a John Doe.
I'm pretty sure the guy's dead out here. Holy s***.
Unidentified and unclaimed for 48 hours because of apparent police red tape. Tonight, Trayvon Martin is anonymous no more.
We all are one.
And tonight, in New York, Martin's parents joined the protest.
Yeah. Trayvon Martin was you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trayvon Martin did matter.
Yeah.
I just want New York to know that we're not going to stop until we get justice for Trayvon.
More than 1,000 people marching in support of the teenager, whose name is now a rallying cry. I'm Matt Gutman for Nightline in Sanford, Florida.
We've been covering the Trayvon Martin story since March 8th, and we've done 8 different stories on it, at least between the online show and the current show. By the way, up until today, according to Think Progress, Fox News had done 1 story. So we're doing 8-to-1 more coverage of this story than Fox News, the entire channel is, right? Because we care about it, and obviously some others don't find it a priority for whatever reasons. Now, I have to confess, though, that as we were covering this, we missed something that I think everyone else has missed as well. But you know who caught it? Our viewers. We put this up on YouTube last night, and then we started getting messages. Hey, you guys missed something that George Zimmerman said. Now, of course, Trayvon Martin's a 17-year-old African-American teenager who was shot down in Sanford, Florida, by George Zimmerman, who was 10 years a senior and had a gun. Trayvon Martin had nothing but Skittles in his pocket, right? So now we showed we played the 911 tapes here, and you hear Zimmerman say things like, they always get away, right? And he's clearly chasing after Trayvon Martin, so Trayvon Martin is not the aggressor George Zimmerman is. But listen to what he says right after, towards the end of this clip here, this is the 911 tape, after he says he's headed towards the back entrance. Listen very, very carefully. Go ahead.
This guy doesn't anything else.
Okay. They always get away. Shit, he's running.
He's running. Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay. Which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
It appears on the tape there that he mumbled under his breath, coons. Now, could it have been something else? You know, could it have been goons? It could have been. It doesn't seem as logical, and it sounds more like coons than goons, right? Mm-hmm. And he mumbles it under his breath. I think that's why everybody missed it, except for the Young Turk viewers. You put anything up on YouTube, and they will dissect it second by second.
Absolutely.
And you guys caught it. So now that you know what we think he's saying, I want to listen to it one more time. Right after he says back entrance there, he seems to mumble under his breath, as you guys caught, the words that I just said. So let's watch again.
Okay, we don't need you to do that. Okay.
Well, I've now listened to it at least half a dozen times. It definitely sounds like coons.
Yeah, given the context as well, it would make much more sense if he said coons rather than goons. So, and I hear the k in that sentence. I don't hear a G.
Right. And look, I'm just trying to be as objective as possible in looking at it, listening to it, and seeing if it could be anything else. But I got to, you know, give it up to our audience. That's a hell of a catch. And thank God we put it up and you guys analyze it, and that's why you're an important part of the show. Thanks for doing that. I think that, does that, you know, certainly speaks to the issue of whether George Zimmerman is a racist or not. And now I see all the time, and so now some conservative talk show hosts have started talking about, oh, it's absurd to think this is a racial issue. Really? Is it still absurd after you hear that?
Original.
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Original.
Are you following him?
EQ1.
Are you following him?
EQ2.
Are you following him?
EQ3.
Are you following him?
EQ4.
Are you following him?
Original.
Are you following him?
Juror B37 decides to do an interview with Anderson Cooper. She is going to keep her identity secret, and given what some are thinking about her now, that's probably a wise thing. Now, I actually don't blame her. I just find all of this to be very instructive. And you begin to get a sense of the perspective of some people in this country, and certainly some of the people that were on the jury. She lets us know that three of the jurors, remember there were six, they were all women, five of them were white. One has not been identified, but a minority of some sort, we believe probably Hispanic, but not black. So she says three of the jurors immediately thought it should be an acquittal. Two of them thought it should be manslaughter, and the sixth person thought it should be a murder charge in the beginning. They all eventually came to the conclusion that it was not guilty. But that's where they began. And she was in the group of three who thought not guilty right from the beginning. And you might begin to understand why when you hear her perspective. Now, first, she had already told George Zimmerman's attorney when he asked her to describe Trayvon Martin, this quote, "He was a boy of color." Now, that's a fascinating way of putting it. Look, I don't want everybody to jump to assumptions against her either, right? Now, there are parts of this country, well, and more importantly, probably generations of this country that used to use colored people as a way of referring to African Americans. It's not very common now, and she doesn't appear to be very old, but okay, it's just one data point, right? When asked about Rachel Jontel, she definitely did not get a favorable view of her testimony, at least. And when asked about the line where Trayvon Martin allegedly called Zimmerman a cracker on the phone, which, by the way, Zimmerman wouldn't have heard, and it would not have led to the confrontation, and it is alleged. Anyway, she thought, well, that's how they speak. I think that's how they live. Now, there's a lot of theys in there. Some people are uncomfortable with that. When asked about Sanford, she said, well, you know, I understand there were some riots there because Zimmerman was not arrested. There were no riots in Sanford, Florida. Apparently that was one of her assumptions. She says she doesn't read the papers at all. She uses it for bird droppings. I believe she has some pets, and she uses it in some way underneath them in her parrot's cage, apparently. Okay. And when talking about this, what happened, the killing of Trayvon Martin, she called it, quote, an unfortunate incident. Okay. Now, that seems to underplay it, but that, you know, again, all these taken by themselves, you know, you could have different opinions on it. I'm not sure they're damning, but let's listen to her. Let's hear her out and get a sense of her perspective. Here's a portion of the interview.
Is George Zimmerman somebody you would like to have on a neighborhood watch in your community?
If he didn't go too far. I mean, you can always go too far. He just didn't stop at the limitations that he should have stopped at.
So, is that a yes, or that if he didn't go too far, is he somebody prone, you think, to going too far?
I think he was frustrated with the whole situation in the neighborhood, with the break-ins and the robberies, and they actually arrested somebody not that long ago. I mean, I would feel comfortable having George, but I think he's learned a good lesson.
So you would feel comfortable having him now because you think he's learned a lesson from all of this?
Exactly. I think he just didn't know when to stop. He was frustrated, and things just got out of hand.
Yeah, that's where she lost me. First of all, I know this appears to be a minor point, but I actually think it's a major point. She constantly refers to Zimmerman as George. She refers to Trayvon as, you know, that boy of color or that boy, etc. Now, look, again, I don't want to overread into it. And I'm not saying she's racist at all, okay? And I don't want people to jump to those conclusions. We can have a conversation about that later. But I think what's much more interesting is her perspective. She seems to identify with Zimmerman at every turn. Oh, well, George, you know, he was an enthusiastic. He just went a little too far. A little too far was when he shot the kid in the chest and killed him. That's not a little too far. That's a lot too far. He just didn't know his limitations a little bit. But that's all right. He's learned his lesson. You see, the perspective there is the most important part. It's not, hey, what a tragedy for this 17-year-old kid who's shot and for the family, etc. And God, is that guy responsible for it? Can I see if he's really guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for this tragic killing of this kid who hadn't done anything wrong, right? He was just walking home to his father's place in a community he belonged in, that he'd spent years in visiting his father, right? The perspective is, well, George, I guess he went a little too far, but come on, are you really going to punish him? Haven't we all gone too far? If you look at it from his perspective and you think like, oh, God, I really, oh, golly gee, George. But it's not just George. There's a dead kid on the ground. How about that dead kid? So, and then the topping on that, of course, is when she says, well, I mean, he's learned his lesson. You know, I don't think he'll kill any more black kids. But anyway, yeah, sure, I'd have him as my neighborhood watchman. I mean, if it was, if you identified with that kid or with that family, you wouldn't begin to contemplate having him as neighborhood watchman of any neighborhood. Remember, he killed someone who lived in the neighborhood. That's a pretty bad watchman. But she's thinking, golly gee, George, you did it again. You overstepped a little bit. So now let's hear more from her and see if we can get more of her perspective.
Do you think he's guilty of something?
I think he's guilty of not using good judgment. When he was in the car and he called 911, he shouldn't have gotten out of that car. But the 911 operator also, when he was talking to him, kind of egged him on. I don't know if it's their policy to tell them what to do, not to get out of the car, to stay in their car. But I think he should have said, stay in your car. Not, can you see where he's gone?
She later went on to say that I think both were responsible for the situation. This is what's so frustrating to me. One guy doesn't have the gun. He got iced tea. He's going to go back home and watch the basketball game with his dad. He's not responsible for starting that fight. If somebody stalks you, and look, again, don't get into the details. And I understand if you say nobody knows the details of who got the upper hand in that fight when there was a fight. I understand that. But to say they're equally responsible, but one of them was just minding his business, the other one was stalking the kid with a gun, and one of them is dead, and the other one's perfectly alive. They're not both equally responsible. What a terrible way to blame the victim. This is one of the jurors, mind you. And then later she says that she felt sorry for Zimmerman. Let me give you another quote. She said, look, I feel sorry for both of them. I feel sorry for Trayvon. That's good. And she's referring to him as Trayvon. They're good. Great. In the situation that he was in. And I feel sorry for George because of the situation he got himself in. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm the bad guy. I feel terrible about the situation, but I don't really feel sorry for George Zimmerman. He didn't have to do any of that. He didn't have to ignore the 911 dispatcher who said, do not follow him. I mean, look, she's given him every break there is. The dispatcher clearly says, don't follow him. But asks, hey, where did he go? Oh, well, that's a good enough excuse for Zimmerman to ignore the order of not following him and follow him. And remember, the whole time he's got the gun, he's got Skittles, right? And she thinks like, well, I feel sorry that he got into that situation. I'm angry that he got himself into that situation. And I guess, you know, And it's not like I can't understand Zimmerman. I get it. In his mind, he wanted to be the hero and he wanted to protect the community. I get that. And I get that he was overzealous and in his mind he was going to be the hero. But does that mean I feel sorry for him? No, he caused that situation. And remember, he's not the one who's dead. Now, finally, what's really interesting is the willful blindness to the issue of race as if it had absolutely nothing to do with this. Remember, these are the people who decided whether Zimmerman was guilty or not guilty. Listen to what she says about the jury's deliberations on race.
Do you feel that George Zimmerman racially profiled Trayvon Martin? Do you think race played a role in his decision, his view of Trayvon Martin as suspicious?
I don't think he did. I think just circumstances caused George to think that he might be a robber or trying to do something bad in the neighborhood because of all that had gone on previously. There were unbelievable a number of robberies in the neighborhood.
So you don't believe race played a role in this case?
I don't think it did. I think if there was another person, Spanish, white, Asian, if they came in the same situation where Trayvon was, I think George would have reacted the exact same way.
Why do you think George Zimmerman found Trayvon Martin suspicious then?
Because he was cutting through the back. It was raining. He said he was looking in houses as he was walking down the road, kind of just not having a purpose to where he was going. He was stopping and starting. But, that's George's rendition of it. But I think the situation where Trayvon got into, him being late at night, dark at night, raining, and anybody would think anybody walking down the road, stopping and turning and looking, if that's exactly what happened, is suspicious. And George had said that he didn't recognize who he was.
Well, was that a common belief on the jury that race did not play a role in this?
I think all of us thought race did not play a role.
So nobody felt race played a role?
I don't think so.
None of the jurors?
I can't speak for them. That wasn't
part of the discussion in the jury room?
No, we never had that discussion.
It didn't come up the question of did George Zimmerman profile Trayvon Martin because he was African American?
No, I think he just profiled him because he was the neighborhood watch and he profiled anybody that came in acting strange. Hmm. I think it was just circumstances happened that he saw Trayvon at the exact time that he thought he was suspicious.
To me, the key there is acting strange, okay? Now, because do you really believe that he was acting strange if he was walking through the rain? That was one of the things she said, I think, twice. And I've heard Zimmerman defenders say that over and over. He was walking in the rain. Well, if you go out to get something in the rain, you didn't cause the rain. Walking in the rain is suspicious by itself. And, you know, Zimmerman's brother mentioned this. She mentions that he was walking slowly. Well, if he was running, I guarantee you would have found it suspicious. Is there a mid-gate that you need to walk so that you're not overly suspicious for being too slow or too fast? He was looking at some of the houses they claimed, Zimmerman claims. And she acknowledges Zimmerman claims, right? Who knows if that's true? And by the way, when I walk, I look at houses. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting house. That's a beautiful house. Does that make me automatically suspicious? My guess is if they saw me, they wouldn't necessarily think I was suspicious. It might depend on the circumstances. And then she said he would sometimes stop and look around. Yes, because he had a weirdo stalking him. If you saw this guy constantly following you, lurking behind you, my guess is you would also stop and look behind you to see what was going on. So why was Trayvon Martin strange to all of these people, whether it was George Zimmerman on that night or whether it's juror B37, who just seems to accept very readily Zimmerman's account of it? The real reason they think he's quote-unquote straight, even though his father lives in the neighborhood, is because, very obviously, let's put it this way, at least you have to consider his race. Do you really believe, and she says there, oh, Asian, white, it doesn't matter. Really, Zimmerman sees an Asian kid walking around in the rain and thinks, I got to go follow this guy, he's the burglar. And juror B37 thinks, absolutely, okay, go hunt him down with a gun. I don't believe him. I think they're being woefully blind. It doesn't necessarily mean they're racist, But it comes, they come at it from a certain perspective. Is there an issue of prejudice? Well, if you automatically think, well, that black guy, well, I think he's suspicious, for even though he's doing things that are perfectly normal, well, that's obviously problematic. And if the jury is not a jury of Trayvon's peers, and it's only a jury of Zimmerman's peers, and prosecutorial negligence here for not having any black people on the jury, because at least in that jury room, you need somebody to step in, up and say, oh, I had a different perspective growing up. Let me tell you my perspective. We can talk about it, and maybe we can come to some sort of joint understanding. Instead, it appears there was a lot of people in that room going, oh, yeah, 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 that kid was strange. I mean, he was wearing hoodies, raining, slow, etc. Well, poor George, how could he have known that that black kid wasn't a thug or a criminal? That, I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but that seemed loud and clear to me. And I actually blame myself a little bit here for my naivete, because I'm surprised by her reaction and her perspective. To say that, you know, that boy of color, you know, who's acting strange, I would have thought that they would could have seen him as their own son. And that's why people said in the beginning, it's good that there's six women. They're not necessarily going to be biased because they're going to see him as their own son. Turns out, they didn't see him as their own son. They saw him as a black kid, not their kid. And I think that we as a country have to talk about this openly, instead of what they did apparently in that jury room, which is to ignore the issue completely, not even discuss it, when it was obviously, at the very least, a giant issue in this case. All right, we can't undo that, but we can now have a conversation and say, hey, wait a minute, what are our assumptions about each other? Let's talk that through, because obviously they're not necessarily correct. Now, you would think that that's obvious, because it turned out Trayvon had Skittles and iced tea and lived in the neighborhood. But to this day, there are people who are Zimmerman fans and supporters who say, no, no, Trayvon was a thug, and he would have at some point gotten a gun or dealt drugs. Again, based on what assumptions? Because presumably he's black. It's hard to talk to those guys, but we got to start talking to each other. Otherwise, those assumptions are going to be set in concrete, and we're never going to get beyond them. And I think that we as a country have to talk about this openly, instead of what they did apparently in that jury room, which is to ignore the issue completely, not even discuss it, when it was obviously, at the very least, a giant issue in this case.
Joining me right now is Manhattan Institute fellow and author of The War on Cops, Heather McDonald. Heather, gosh, how many times am I going to sit here and have this conversation with you? It's a scary time to be a cop right now. It feels like it's getting worse. What is your sense of where we're heading right now?
Well, it is getting worse, Trish. Gun killings of officers are up 61% this year compared to the previous year. And what has to happen is the lies have to stop coming out of the White House about the police and shootings.
And the White House will tell you, it's the police officers' fault. They're the ones creating this hostile environment that makes it more likely for themselves to get hurt.
Well, they are putting out the Black Lives Matter narrative, which is that we're living through an epidemic of racially biased police killings of blacks. That narrative, which is utterly false, is resulting in some instances, at least, in the targeted assassination of police officers, as we saw in Dallas in July, and I think most likely in San Antonio. That is a false narrative. Mm-hmm. Obama has not contradicted it. We can only hope
he's
that...
he said it, right? I mean, and we've talked about this before, in part,
sure,
for political purposes. By the way, it didn't get him anywhere. It didn't get the left anywhere. Black Lives Matter. You know, if you're an African-American living in a challenged community right now, Heather, I mean, I'd be saying, I just want to be safe.
Of course. And black lives are being lost as well as blue lives. When officers back off of proactive policing in high crime areas, as they're doing now, mm-hmm, thanks to this false narrative, the people who most need their help are being hurt. So, yes, Barack Obama has not contradicted, he has fed the narrative, and the fact is that support for the cops is right now at an all-time high, the highest since 1967, because the public understands that if you continue to undercut the legitimacy of the police the way we've experienced in the last 2 years, there's going to be some lunatics who take their hatred one step further. They're not just cursing at cops, which is what's going on. They're not just throwing things at cops. They're shooting at them. This has to stop, and I just hope that Donald Trump will start telling the truth about crime and policing.
Well, this has been part of his platform, right? Law and order. We need to bring back law and order to our streets so our young people, our communities are safe.
This is the fundamental responsibility of government. When families break down and you have young males roaming the streets without any parental control, the only hope that for those law-abiding residents is for the cops. And law and order, if we can't provide that as a society, we provide nothing else.
Heather McDonald, thank you so much.
Thank you, Trish.
You know, I keep having this conversation with you, but it's an important conversation that has to be had.
Yeah.
And they have to listen. All right, thank you so much.
There is no contradiction between us supporting law enforcement, making sure they've got the equipment they need, making sure that their collective bargaining rights are recognized, making sure that they're adequately staffed, making sure that they are respected, making sure their families are supported, and also saying that there are problems across our criminal justice system. There are biases, some conscious and unconscious, that have to be rooted out. That's not an attack on law enforcement. That is reflective of the values that the vast majority of law enforcement bring to the job. But I repeat, if communities are mistrustful of the police, that makes those law enforcement officers who are doing a great job and are doing the right thing, it makes their lives harder. So you know, when people say Black Lives Matter, that doesn't mean blue lives don't matter. It just means all lives matter. But right now, the big concern is the fact that the data shows Black folks are more vulnerable to these kinds of incidents. This isn't a matter of us comparing the value of lives. This is recognizing that there is a particular burden that is being placed on a group of our fellow citizens. And we should care about that. We can't dismiss it.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Ramir Deez. Welcome to this episode of the Class War Battle Field Podcast. Ooh, the legacy of Occupy Wall Street is yelling loud and I have a theory, ladies and gentlemen. I have a theory. A lot of you may find this theory interesting. Some of you may find it implausible. Nonetheless, I have a theory. Undoubtedly, the Occupy Wall Street protests wasn't really a movement because it didn't spark any organization of power. It couldn't be co-opted, so that wasn't, it wasn't going to directly lead to any significant appropriation by the Democratic or Republican Party. I refuse to use that whole Democrat thing, which is just stupid. Even progressives who are picking that up need to be ashamed, because that's a right-wing creation. It was started back in the 1990s, and it was done to divorce the Democratic Party from its FDR legacy. But that's another tantrum for another day, I suppose. Anyway, so the Occupy Wall Street was held too much energy to be really, and too much authenticity to be really grouped in with the Democratic Party. Nonetheless, there were some lessons that were learned, and there were some actions that were undertaken by the elite after Occupy Wall Street was shut down. The first action, and I'm not really going to do this in order or anything, but this is really the crux. This is what started, and not really the crux, but the seed of where all this started. Over the last 6-7 months, I've been watching the media, and there has been, well, it's gone a little bit more than the last 6 months. It's gone probably for the last two and a half years. But definitely over the last 6 months is when it kind of started coming together in my mind. There has been this push to demonize black men in the black community and their interactions with police officers. I have watched how the media has done this and started to note that the media was more interested in stoking the agitation between or stoking agitation between the two groups, black people and police officers, than they were at actually getting down to the root causes and presenting solutions to those causes. Watching the questioning of, and I completely blame this on CNN and Fox News. I don't watch as much MSNBC, so I can't speak to them, but definitely from watching CNN and Fox News, the interviews were always interested in creating agitation between black people and police officers. What does this have to do with Occupy, you're wondering? Here's where the lesson comes in. One of the major failings of Occupy Wall Street was that it really didn't have any connection to the real grassroots. And by the real grassroots, I'm talking about black and non-white communities. Black, brown, and red communities. They just didn't have that connection. And this was a huge point of criticism, especially for many black people, black radicals particularly, who had been in the black community talking about the issues which Occupy Wall Street was protesting. There were several articles I remember reading, detailed articles at that, where these radicals were saying, where are these Occupy Wall Street protesters? We would love to talk to them and let them know this is what's happening in our communities, and this has been happening in our communities for 2 or 3 or 4 decades, and
you all now have a problem because it's happening to you. If it was not happening to you, you would not be out here protesting. So there's a little bit of hostility there. When Trayvon Martin was shot dead by George Zimmerman, people forget the United States government was finishing up its destruction of the Occupy Wall Street camp, and it was enhancing its surveillance on its leaders and doing what it could do to either bribe those leaders or to neutralize them. We forget this. Occupy, even though it didn't have a residence in Zuccotti Park anymore, and seriously, I encourage all of you, Google the images, because I think most of you have forgotten about those images of what Zuccotti Park turned into after the New York Police Department, with aid from the Department of Homeland Security, blew through Zuccotti Park and kicked all of the inhabitants out. You need to remind yourself of those pictures and then think about where we're at today with migrant children in cages. Make a comparison, because ladies and gentlemen, if you do not believe that there's a connection from one to the other, see those pictures. Remind yourself of the police presence in Boston, Occupy Boston, the police presence in Oakland, and all across the country. And then bring back the images of Ferguson, of Baltimore, and then compare it to where, see, there's all, it's all connected. But anyway, we forget they were getting done wrapping up the Occupy Wall Street protesters and the leaders. And up until, I think, the summer of 2012, Occupy Wall Street was still in the news. It was still making headlines. There were still young people, particularly, using the hashtag Occupy to make noise at the UN, to make noise at various other conferences. I can't remember if it was 2012 or 2013, where there was Occupy Sandy. There was actually actual offshoots of Occupy doing humanitarian work on the ground with people who had lost their homes and their communities were devastated by natural disasters, and there were still people wearing this Occupy concept with them. But here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. 2012, when Trayvon Martin was murdered, that was the first time you heard mainstream media start talking about something called black social media, black Twitter, black Facebook. In other words, a place where black people were talking to each other in the social media landscape, which was wholly detached from what was often thought of as the mainstream of social media. So you had Twitter, but inside Twitter you had black Twitter. Inside Twitter you had this community that nobody had really paid attention to until Trayvon Martin was murdered, and suddenly the news media, the mainstream news media, didn't pay attention to it. Not even your major people over at MSNBC didn't pay attention to it. But suddenly you started seeing all these black blogs start doing stories about it. You started seeing black people posting on their Facebook pages about it, tweeting about it, talking about it on YouTube. And the mainstream media said, whoa, wait a minute. We didn't cover this. Where'd it come from? And that's when they discovered this thing called black social media. And this was frightening to them. Because, see, they didn't even know it existed. Now, you have to understand something, ladies and gentlemen, because you think I'm just telling you this story for nothing. But these people were frightened by Occupy Wall Street. Why? I've mentioned it before, because of how fast it spread. It spread so quickly, in 3 weeks, it was across the country, it was all over. It shocked them. They knew they had a problem. So after this thing, which blew up out of nowhere, suddenly they discover a group which they were already skeptical about, that's black people, because, you know, despite what they like to talk about when it comes to black people, you know, we kill each other, we, you know, have bad self-esteem and all this other stuff, their biggest fear is that 1960 is going to happen again, which is all of us getting together and putting our foot down and saying, we're done. You will do what we say or we're shutting your country down. That's their fear. So when black people didn't protest with Occupy Wall Street, they went, huh, whew, man, awesome. Yeah, we got them N-words right where we want them. They are going to do nothing. And don't get it twisted. A lot of them really do look at us that way. But they did. They looked at us and said, you're not going to do anything. Black people, I mean, look at this huge, just gigantic protest movement, which you weren't even a part of. Man, you were just there. We have you. And then Trayvon Martin is murdered. And they say, huh, another dead black man. Who the hell cares? And before they realize anything, black people care. And there's a problem. Because they weren't telling black people to care. They were not telling them to care. And then they discover this thing called black social media, a network within a network, which black people were using to communicate with each other. And when they started studying it, they were shocked by what they discovered, what they found. We were self-sufficient and independent within their own social media structures, and that frightened them. Because another thing that they knew, they've written white pages about this, and if you don't know what a white page is, Google it. But they have. They've written white pages about this. If black people do something, white people, especially young white people, and even not so young white people, tend to also do it. So yes, white folks led the Occupy Wall Street protests. But that doesn't happen often. Usually when black people start moving, that's when white people start moving. I mean, they've tried to change that dynamic over the last four decades. So that what happened in the 1960s wouldn't happen again, which was that poor black people and lower middle class black people led the charge, led the movements. Because there's a consciousness that comes with that. It's not to say that Europeans, white people, don't have consciousness. It's just we view things very differently. And if you know any real black folks, I'm not talking about the ones that grew up around white people, you know, got educated solely by white people. No, 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 no. Because most of them folks think like they're white. And this isn't even to take anything away from them either. But it's the truth. When you get around those folks that the majority of their time was spent around black people. We think differently, and they know it. And even when black people become activated and they have been born and raised and bred around white folks and they become activated, we think differently. Something comes out of us. That Africanness comes out of us. We have a more socialistic view of things. And these people, they know what they've been studying. All of us. They know what we think and how we think. So their biggest thing was always to stop black and white folks, especially from the lower classes and the lower middle class, from ever getting together. When they found this out, this freaked them out. So they had to do something about it. And what they did about it was they implemented a plan. Now, I don't know when they implemented the plan, but the plan became very obvious. It became very, very obvious in 2014. That plan was to change the way that the public viewed black protestations over police brutality. They wanted white people to see black people as, one, not having respect for police officers, which is a conservative talking point. That is a conservative talking point that has been there since the 1970s. And then, two, that black people hated police officers. But then there was even another point that they wanted to emphasize, and you see this a lot, is that it wasn't just black people, it was leftist white people too. That was the plan. And I gotta be honest, I don't believe that this plan was just created out of thin air, because again, they've used this plan before, but, with George Zimmerman, a narrative arose, especially among conservatives and white people who were conservatives. And that was that Trayvon Martin was always in the wrong. But not only was he always in the wrong, but that George Zimmerman was essentially a police officer without a badge, and Trayvon Martin should have respected him. When Michael Brown, it really started with Eric Garner, but Michael Brown was killed. And there's something that I got to say about Eric Garner, but I'm gonna wait and get back to that. When Michael Brown was killed, this conservative narrative pitting black people against police officers was put into full effect. Now, why is this important? This is important, again, because of Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street, the organizers of Occupy Wall Street, and even the protesters in Occupy Wall Street, the ones that were trained, not the ones that were sent in, you know, the black bloc group of people who, really honest to God, anybody in their right minds look at and say, yeah, that's not a police sting operation. Of course those people are infiltrators. They are police officers working double duty. Anyway, the Occupy Wall Street protesters made it a point to not go after police officers negatively. They were always using, they were always careful to see the police officers not as a threat, but as a group of people who themselves were being lied to and mistreated. See, we forget about that because we're so involved in this negativity now that we just forget about this. But that was what Occupy Wall Street pounded into its protesters. You were not to demonize the police, which made it even more obvious that Black Bloc was a police infiltration propaganda tool because they immediately started smearing the police officers when it was clear that Occupy Wall Street was not about that, that all the Occupy Wall Street protesters were not about that. Now, I'm not saying that black people wouldn't have had issues with police officers, because they would have, but the strategy was very, very keen on the fact that if you demonize the police officers, they will have no problem operating on behalf of the 1% to crush what you were doing. This isn't obviously talking about the and I hate to use this phrase, but there are those who work for the police departments that are boneheads, who basically look for a fight wherever they're walking. That's not to say every cop is that way, but you do have those, and it's time that we start talking about that, because if you are a good cop and you cannot say that there are some boneheads on your force, then you ain't a good cop. That's a reality. Sorry to hurt your feelings, but you're not. I think it was Dr. King who said it, that all it takes for evil to prosper is for good men to do nothing. I'll just leave that there. Anyway, Occupy Wall Street was very, 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 very vigilant about this. There were always signs that were saying the police are the 99%. Police are the 99%. I don't know if you remember a viral video. I mean, this shows you just how warped our minds have become in the past 7 or 8 years, because we don't even remember this stuff anymore. But I don't know if you remember the viral video of the sergeant, I don't even remember his name, the sergeant who went to New York City to check out Occupy Wall Street. It was late at night, not really late, but it was nighttime. And the police officers were moving in an aggressive stance towards these citizens, these people who were doing nothing wrong, who had no weapons. And this sergeant, who had come back from Afghanistan, he was wearing his flak jacket, and he started yelling at him, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this to these people? Why are you doing this to our people? I went," he said, "to Afghanistan. I fought for these people to be able to do this. What are you doing? These people have no guns. You shouldn't be doing this." And there was one police officer, a white guy. Shouldn't matter, but it does, because the sergeant was black. And to show you that it wasn't just racial solidarity, as some of the racist police officers would actually have you believe. And those actually exist, ladies and gentlemen, sorry, but they do. The white guy said to him, and the look on his face really said it all, because he's seen this military personnel standing across from him. And let's be very, very fair about this. When it comes to police officers, they are an extension of the military, ladies and gentlemen. We need to always remember this. They are. Their whole structure is militaristic. They are an extension of the military. This is why often in what are called third world countries, or were called third world countries, you would see the military blending in with the police department to do various raids and to do various criminal activities that really resulted in people getting injured or killed. It's just one big happy family. It's just one is civilian and one is non-civilian. The military is not a civilian force. That said, this police officer looked at this man in his flak jacket, wearing his medals, wearing his insignias, and said, "I was right there with you, brother." And so the man turned to him and said, "Then what are you doing? Why are you doing this to our people?" And that changed the entire mood of that whole police squad. It shut him down. Ladies and gentlemen, first and foremost, before I continue with the narrative that I begin on, I just want to tell you, that frightened the heart out of NYPD. Because those Police officers put their guns, lowered their guns, lowered their weapons. Their whole stance changed because this man who was military went to them and got them to stand down. The biggest fear that the wealthy have, which is why they pass all this legislation about the military being able to go onto the streets, or supposedly, you know, they say there's a section in one of the defense authorization bills that gives them the right to do this. I've never read it, but I hear that it's supposedly out there. But the biggest fear that they have is that police departments, which are connected to the communities, even if it's not the direct communities that they are policing, they are connected to the ones surrounding it. Their biggest fear is that they will, that those police officers will, their loyalties will be to those individual civilians, not to the elite. So you want a better group of trained killers that won't listen to reason. They'll just listen to bullets. In other words, they'll speak in violence first and then ask questions later. And that's the fear of the elite speaking. That said, that fear was real. And since that black man was able to do this to these white officers and get them to stand down all because he was military, I'm not saying that that helped them figure out that that's what they had to do, that they had to then go after this bond between the black community and police departments, because Lord knows that bond has been frayed for a long time. But I will say the power of the military, of the ordinary soldier over the police department, that was seen. And they made a decision to break that bond. As I said, we could see it in full display. We could see it in full display when Michael Brown died. And if you noticed, after Michael Brown died particularly, it took Michael Brown to die because, you know, Michael Brown was, he had the type of face and the structure which they could use as a boogeyman. He was big. He was big. He was dark. And they could paint him as a monster. Now, because, you know, we're literally just passing the marking of his murder. We passed the marking of Eric Garner's murder a couple of months ago. There are things that I want to talk about with them too that need to be talked about, but we need to really understand that there has been this game played, a long game played, to pit the police officers against the civilians. We need to understand that, because if you don't, it's even to the point, ladies and gentlemen, and I don't even like saying this, but I feel like I have to say it. It's even to the point where I wonder if a person like so much of what you see on TV is staged. Whether you're talking about traumas, reality TV, which isn't, sports, so much of it is staged. And it makes me sometimes question what is real and what isn't. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to get too far into that. But there is a move to divest police officers of their connection to their communities, to make them question their allegiance to specific communities and their communities and specific members of their communities. This isn't to say that police departments and police officers don't have their own consciousness and none of that. This isn't to say that. But if you watch what the media has been doing, there has definitely been a discernible pattern to ramp up the agitation between police departments and civilians, particularly non-white civilians and the police departments. And it's time that we ask the question, why? News came out recently. This has actually been stated for the last couple of years that this was actually projected to happen. The question is when, and right now it looks like it's going to be just in time for the 2020 election, which makes me again wonder how much of this is planned. How much of it is planned? But anyway, news has come out that there is going to be a recession. Like I said, they've been talking about this for the last couple of years. They were talking about this likely starting in 2019. Now they're pushing it to 2020. Some wonder if we've not already entered it. But it could get dramatic and it could get bad. If things continue to deteriorate, let's say Mr. Trump gets another 4 years, what is going to be needed, especially if the Democratic Party does what they are already signaling that they're going to do, which is deprive the people of the candidate which they want? What is it going to take to stuff that kind of animosity and anger back into the bottle from which it came from? What is it going to take? As I've said before, I've said this a couple of times, and I need to reiterate this. We need to start understanding and maybe accepting the fact that these wealthy people wanted Donald Trump in the White House. And we need to start understanding that they weren't afraid of Donald Trump, but they were afraid of Hillary Clinton. And the question is, why? I know everyone, you know, the concept now is to, or should I say, the popular action today is beat up on the Clintons. I can remember the 1990s. Most people can't remember the 1990s. I can. Every other day, they were smashing the Clintons. And the question was, why? I know, I'm not supposed to ask these questions. I don't care. They need to be answered. I'm not saying that I'm all in for Hillary Clinton. I'm not saying that I am a Clintonite. I'm saying that these are questions that need to be answered. Oh, they're scum. They're this, they're that. Ladies and gentlemen, the elite have a bunch of people who are scum. But for God's sake, man. Two times people associated with Clintons have been, three times, excuse me, have been denied the White House. And don't get it twisted. Barack Obama didn't run as a Clintonite. He wasn't a Clintonite. In fact, he wasn't nowhere near Clintonite. But why is this happening? That's a question that needs to be answered. So assuming Donald Trump gets his other 4 years, I know you don't want to even think about that, but ladies and gentlemen, you need to figure out what you're going to do if he does get another 4 years. Plan for it, but work against it. What is it going to take if things really do get bad? What's it going to take? to put all of that animosity and that anger back into the bottle from which it came out. These are times which demand calm reasonableness and real choices. Dr. King said that. They are making moves against a mass protest. I read House Resolution, I think it was 246, if memory serves me correctly, and that's something that, ladies and gentlemen, you all need to get, and you need to put it somewhere where you can see it every single day. It's 2 pages. It's the anti-BDS resolution, and you need to do it not because it is anti-BDS, ladies and gentlemen, even though that needs to speak to you too. Boycott, divest, and sanction, because what they're essentially saying, I'll take care of that in a moment. You need to get it not because it's BDS, but you need to get it because it is speaking to the future of how they're going to deal with movements that have an economic underpinning to them. And this actually goes all the way back to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Remember what happened when people were going to banks, and saying, I want to take out my money so I can put it somewhere else because I don't want to support these banks who got bailed out and didn't do anything to help Main Street. They were divesting, ladies and gentlemen. What were they told? Because they were not only divesting, they were showing their displeasure, which, by the way, capitalism says you're supposed to be able to do this. If you have displeasure with an institution, you have a right to take your money out. This is capitalism. Capitalism says you are supposed to be able to do this. Take your money out and put it somewhere else. At the same time, they were boycotting and they were divesting. That's what they were doing. And what happened? I think it was Bank of America. It might have been another bank. But down in Texas, they literally shut these people in. Wouldn't let them leave. Said you cannot be at once a boycotter, a protester, and a customer. Which that should hit you in the mind, ladies and gentlemen. Because what do they call you? Walk into a post office. Especially one, if you've been going to a post office for 20 years, realize now, they don't call you a citizen in the post office, they call you a customer. You cannot be a customer and a protester at the same time. They are showing you with this anti-BDS resolution, sure, it's not legislation, it's not law, it's not legal tender, it's not anything like that. But what it's telling you is the spirit that they are going to be following. And this better wake you up, because this is how they view your attempts to fix their system. It ain't yours. If you ain't figured yet, you are a rat in their system. You are a cash cow in their system. And they don't want you mucking up their system with your ideas of reforming it and fixing it. They are worried about an Occupy-level economic movement that forces the system to capitulate to the demands of the masses. That's what they are fearful of. That's why they are afraid of Bernie Sanders. That's why they're excluding Tulsi Gabbard from the debate. They do not want a genuine revolution. Revolutions don't have to be violent. And they know this. And they know also that from an astrological standpoint, we are in a period of time when there is going to be severe upheaval socially. And it is warranted. It could come in two ways. It could come in the ways of innovation, which will break the back of slavery, that has been imposed by capitalist nonsense, but really capitalist philosophy, onto all of the Americans who are living in this country and all of the people who are living abroad. It'll break that slaver concept, that energy. It'll just break it. Or it can come in social turmoil. And that's what they want, because they can speak in that language. Innovation is going to decentralize everything. You notice they're going after the government as a centralized force at the same time that they are encouraging massive conglomerization of companies, mergers, acquisitions. They're going after centralized government and saying that's horrible, that's terrible, stop it, at the same time that they are promoting centralization of corporate power. I'm not saying that that is concerning. I am saying that you should be alarmed. Because if they tear apart the government, who's going to stand up for your rights? Nobody. They'll privatize the military, as they're already starting to do, well on their way, by the way. And then they'll use that privatized military to inflict control onto the society, which they've done in other countries. They are setting you against police officers and police departments, because that's the only way that they can divide you from those who have the training and the know-how to protect you. Now, I said that I wanted to say a couple of things about Eric Gardner and Michael Brown. And I want to say these things not because I want to dig all of that back up. No. But there are some huge things that need to be said, because the record needs to be corrected. I'm going to start with Michael Brown, because that may be the easiest one. A couple of years after Michael Brown died, a video was released quietly by the police department, or maybe it was the DA's department, but either way, a video was released quietly, which decriminalized Mr. Brown. What am I talking about? If you remember, for Michael Brown, a video was quickly circulated by the then sheriff of Michael Brown supposedly strong-arming a store owner and taking some Black and Miles. Now, I don't know if all y'all know what those are, but they're pretty much little slim cigar-looking things. They look like, they're like a combination of cigars and cigarettes. They're brown, but they're slim like cigarettes. That helped to solidify this notion of Michael Brown as this thug presence who was angry and guerrilla-ish, and he needed to be shot down for his own good. You know, that was what many gun owners and conservatives utilized to say that he was a bad person, was that video. Well, if you also remember, the store owner quickly challenged that narrative. He gave an interview. I still remember the interview. I don't know if you can find it anymore. But he gave an interview where he said, look, this just didn't happen. okay? He didn't really strong-arm me. It was a misunderstanding, yada, yada, yada. That thing appeared for like 2 minutes and was gone. Even MSNBC ran with the story that Michael Brown was pretty much being a jerk and taking this stuff and, you know, but that shouldn't still have resulted in his death. And that had nothing to do with him actually being stopped by the cops. In other words, what they said was, and this was kind of interesting because this was the narrative that was utilized for him, was that Michael Brown had stolen these cigarette-looking thingies, and then he got shot. Kind of sounds like Eric Gardner. Eric Gardner was selling Lucy's cigarettes, and then he got chokeholded to death. Well, this new video showed that what... There was another story that came out at the time, which said something to the effect that Michael Brown had actually paid another one of the cashiers there for the money, for those Swisher Sweets, for those Black and Milds, and then he had come to pick them up, and at first, apparently, the owner wasn't willing to give it to him because he thought that he was stealing them, and then there was some translation, some whatever, whatever, and... Oh, I'm sorry, actually, because I was about to tell you the bogus story, but it was all a misunderstanding, and then secondly, it was all a interaction between the owner and Michael Brown. Both of them knew each other, in other words. Both of them knew each other, and what you saw partially on that tape was the two of them exchanging pleasantries. But you also saw just some goofing around and what have you. But the videotape that was released, like, quietly, very quietly, showcased that he had indeed paid for those Black and Milds. In other words, the whole concept, this whole notion, this videotape that had helped people believed that Michael Brown was this serious threat was a fake. It was only a little snippet of the story. Why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this, ladies and gentlemen, because one, that was part of the beginning of this narrative that was Black people, civilian versus police. And two, that is a hell of a conspiracy. And I'm not joking. You had people who had to know that this other part of this tape existed, sitting on it for 4 years, and then suddenly releasing it quietly. That's a hell of a conspiracy. Now, the second one that I want to tell you about is an even deeper one. I've talked about this, actually, I think, with you guys. But it needs to be reiterated because this drives me nuts. Every time when I hear people talk about Eric Gardner, they always bring up the fact that he was selling loose cigarettes as the reason why the police officers had stopped to mess with him. But ladies and gentlemen, if you go back and you check the tape, and I encourage you to, please go back and check the tape, the I Can't Breathe tape, go all the way back to the beginning of it and listen to it. Eric Gardner says repeatedly that he had nothing on him. He had no cigarettes, he wasn't selling anything, and he told him that. He said, you did not see me sell a cigarette, I have no cigarettes on me, I'm tired of you messing with me, leave me alone. That's important, ladies and gentlemen, because whether you're Rachel Maddow, or you're Anderson Cooper, or you're the thugs over at Fox News, Everybody says that the reason he was in that situation is because he was doing something wrong. Same thing with Michael Brown. They did something wrong, and that's why they were in that position. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a lie. Eric Gardner did not have cigarettes. He didn't have Lucy's. He wasn't selling anything. He had nothing. Do you know why the police department was there harassing him that day? Now, before I tell you that, let me remind you of something that I said. Black people may have had an issue with those Occupy Wall Street people saying the police are the 99% because black people knew the thuggery that went on in the police department. And they knew how police departments criminalized black people and how they treated us. So yes, they may be the 99%, but they're in a very, very abusive relationship right now. In fact, they're in an abusive family. And in an abusive family, what happens? If the father is abusing the mother will abuse the child. If the child doesn't have a brother or sister to abuse, they will abuse an animal. But if they have a brother and sister to abuse, they will abuse that brother and sister. In other words, police officers are in an abusive relationship with this society. They are getting abused every day of their lives, and guess what they do? Many of them take it out on the people who they are patrolling, and particularly those who they deem as less important in society, aka black people, brown people, red people. Eric Gardner was not selling cigarettes, but he was a threat to those people. Do you know why they were there? They were there because there was a fight about to happen. Ah, I got you. They were there because there was a fight about to happen. And Eric Gardner, who was well known in the community, he was a pillar in the community, some people would probably say. Eric Gardner stopped that from happening. He stopped two non-white people from fighting each other. And for his trouble, and he actually, if I'm not mistaken, he says this on the video, that they were fighting. And he stopped them from fighting. And for his trouble, he was murdered. Now, why is this important? Because, ladies and gentlemen, I bring you back to the fear of this society. They don't want peace-creating black people in the black community. No. They want peace-creating black people in the white community. Talking a good game, but doing nothing for black people. Because trust me when I tell you, I've heard enough of these educated black people to understand that the stuff half the time that they're talking about ain't useful. It's not. It's very nice from a book standpoint, but it makes white people feel good. But from an actional point, it's just not feasible. It's not going to work. You're going to have to get just a little bit more critical of the system before you can actually start seeing what needs to be done. Everyone's trying to become part of the system, not realizing the system is the problem. It's the thing that's actually killing the people and hurting the people. You can't become a part of a system that's destructive. You gotta tear it down and build something better. People like Eric Gardner, who would manifest peace by their presence, who understood the streets, who understood the ghetto mentality, and could utilize that brilliance, that intelligence to facilitate peace. That is, from a policing standpoint, a threat. Because then those people can organize others. I ain't saying this is what was going through the minds of these people. No. What I'm saying is, though, that That's what is actually a part of being a police officer. They learn how to identify threats, even when those threats are nonviolent. Police officers' primary job, if you look at it from a spiritual point, is to stop an insurrection. What is an insurrection? No, I'm serious. What is an insurrection? You got a dictionary. Look it up. They want to stop an insurgency, which is so funny because I always love that. Insurgency, which is an insurge. What is a surge? That's an energy. That's a push of an energy. Well, where does that energy come from? The Most High? I guess it could be negative. But you only make something negative if you bottle it up and it has nowhere to go. Then it explodes. This is what social work was supposed to accomplish. But that's another story. Ladies and gentlemen, I am going to leave this alone for the time being because, man, I've been talking with y'all for about an hour. Man, was this fiery. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, the email is always there. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask, God, I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. When you know that you've seen it before. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vladimir Deese. And the country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.